back last night, I walk inside, and there's this thing under my bed, so I'm like, yeah. I know the friend came over, he said he wanted to come over, but I knew he wasn't there, like, in my room. Obviously, he won't go into my room. I was like, okay, what's this shit? So, like, my bed. Like,
good.
Thank you. All right, sorry for the slight delay in getting started here. What I'm going to do is to really do two things today. One which is going to be somewhat helpful to everybody in kind of making sure everybody is up to speed on the practical. The other one's more advanced and really is going to be on a topic which is unexaminable, but which is not unexaminable, we could examine it, but we're not going to, which is going to be telling you really about the technology behind the practical. So the technology behind is this System C simulation language. And I want to walk you through a bit about what's going on with System C and kind of what's going on with the underlying C++. But this is more for your interest and entertainment. It's not in any way material that I'm going to expect you to know for this course, but it's just kind of whet your appetite to kind of tell you for your interest about what's going on when you're doing the practical, and just to kind of tell you a bit about, you'll see a tiny bit about C++ too, so in future years you may well want to do some C++ programming, and you might be curious about how it, say, is similar or different, similar to Java, or say differs from Java. All right, so first things first, let's talk about the practical. Says here, now we should have two pictures. And that. All right, so how many of you have had a chance to look at the practical yet? Ooh, great. Very good. So if you've had a look, actually especially if you haven't, so it's all about considering this data path, or this processor memory LU system at the top here. So what you're given for the practical is a description of this in this System C language. And it's a multi-cycle processor, similar to, but not the same as, the one that you saw a few lectures ago. And the design, the code for it is incomplete. And in particular, the code is missing how the control unit for this, which actually isn't shown in the diagram, how the control unit steers the data and controls where the data is coming from and going to for several instructions. So I'll give you the control unit code for two or three instructions, and then I ask you to write the extra control unit code for the rest of the instructions. And the way that the practical goes is that you're really designing, so you're designing the control unit, you're designing the finite state machine within the control unit. And the assignment's very much one of studying, understanding very well what's being shown in this diagram here, and then being able to draw up a truth table for each instruction, saying on the second cycle, this, I don't know, add instruction has to do the following. It has to fetch data from the register file, and in this design, it can actually perhaps both fetch data and add data in the same cycle. That's something different, say, from between this design and the design that you saw previously. So you've got to then figure out, well, how do I get the data to go that way? So that's the kind of essence of the practical. And to actually complete the practical, you'd be drawing up this truth table in a spreadsheet program. You can use OpenOffice or use Excel. Eventually, I want you to submit an OpenOffice version and a PDF version of this table for the control unit. And then, two, you're going to be writing some, you're really writing C++ code, but I'm calling it C code because at the level of syntax you're working, you're really only ever typing C constructs. So you're programming in C, actually using control constructs very similar to those that you've seen from Java. So the coding part ought to be fairly straightforward. The debugging part should be somewhat straightforward too. You'll be compiling a C++ program. When C++ programs go wrong, they can go horribly wrong with really grotesque error messages. I think the kinds of errors that you will make will not cause those error messages. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I'm hoping they won't. If they do, kind of grab your nearest lab demonstrator or C++ expert and ask him or her. I'm hoping that won't be an issue. And then really to debug, you'll be using this GTK wave waveform viewer that will be showing you what's happening in your simulation. So I'm hoping that debugging will be more, it'll be debugging what you've set up this control unit to do. So it'll be debugging functionality, maybe even going back to this truth table you've drawn and debugging this truth table. It won't be debugging the syntax of C or C++. You ought to get that okay fairly easily, is my expectation. All right, so that's what the practical's about. I wanted to spend a couple of minutes just making sure that when all of you are looking at this diagram here, that you're actually interpreting it properly and accurately, because unless you can look at this picture and see more than a bunch of straight lines and letters, unless the functionality logic there jumps out at you, you won't be able to do the practical. So your first job is to understand what's going on here. So I just want to make sure, well, I kind of wanted to go over that and just check with you, get back from you some any immediate questions that you might have, just to make sure that we're all on the same page there here, and that you kind of got the grounding to go forward with this practical. So the first thing to realize is that we're working with synchronous logic. And with synchronous logic, that the key thing is that you are dealing with registers which hold state, and then between the registers are combinational logic. So you kind of got, if you look at a part of, sometimes people draw pictures like this. This chalk, it seems a bit kind of faint to me. Can you actually see this chalk at the back there? Or is it a bit hazy? It's okay?
A bit hazy.
Bit hazy. Once upon a time, there was stuff called super chalk, but which really kind of gave you thick white lines. And maybe if I just press harder, I'll try pressing harder. Or maybe on these. Yeah, on these boards, things work a lot better. I will. Let me try using this, pressing harder, then if it. Okay. All right, so with synchronous logic, people often draw diagrams like this. And they say, well, look, I've got some registers here, and I've got some registers here, and I've got some combination logic here. This is an abstraction of lots of what you see up there. And there's this key idea that that the registers really are that they're sampling devices, that you have a clock signal coming in here, and on every positive edge of clock, registers sample the data coming in and then hold that data until the next positive edge of clock. So with a kind of basic system of with this basic configuration of a synchronous system like this, so in general, kind of, I've just drawn two registers here, but as you've got up there, you've got many different registers, and between different registers, you've got different kinds of combination logic, but in every case, it's combination logic separating registers. So you've got if we call let's call this I don't know if we even need names for these things. We'll call this register one and this register two. Maybe we'll need those names. We'll see. So we've got a clock signal. Nice square wave. And say on the positive edges are where, so this is our clock signal again, clock waveform. And the positive edges, these registers are sampling inputs and copying those inputs to the outputs. So there's the idea that if we call the signals here, say A, and the signals here coming out of the combination B to this register here B, that the idea is after each positive clock edge, shortly after, we look at the signals at A, the signals at A become stable and then are held stable for the rest of the clock cycle. So this is kind of the start of the story of what happens on a clock cycle. And then through the clock cycle, these values of signals that appear at A propagate through all the gates of the combination logic here. Now, the thing to remember about combination logic in a synchronous system is that there are no loopbacks in that combination logic. There's always this idea of data flowing forward through the different gates. And eventually, what happens with the combination logic is the signals all propagate out to here. And after the length of time for the longest delay through this combination logic, the signals at B will eventually stabilize. So if we come back to our waveform diagram, if we look at what's happening at B, then shortly after A changes, signals at B are going to start to change. There might be some very fast paths through that combinational logic. And then signals are going to continue changing throughout most of the cycle. And conventionally, with these waveform diagrams, we often kind of put a bunch of X's in here to indicate that. And at some time, before the next clock cycle, we expect the data at B to stabilize. And then on this clock edge here, then, the data that's arrived at B is sampled. So that's that basic function with synchronous logic is crucial to understand in order to kind of appreciate what's going on up here. So just at this rather abstract level, are there any kind of questions about our picture of synchronous logic? We talked about it before, but I wanted to go over it again just to make sure that you've all got this picture here, because without it, you're going nowhere. Any questions? You're all somewhat comfortable with this. All right, so let's see this. Let's now kind of, in this language, talk about what's going on with our real design. Or that this design that we're looking at here. So the first thing we've got to do is to figure out the first thing we've got to do is figure out where the registers are. All right, let's try again. Am I on? Yes. Yeah, so the first thing to do is figure out where the registers are. So there's lots of acronyms here, but basically I would say actually been pretty consistently drawn. So almost every rectangular box in this diagram contains registers. It might contain something else, but also contains registers. So here we've got the program counter, these things here, this is called a memory address register. Things ending with R usually are registers. So this is a register, this is a register, these things are registers. Register file's got lots of registers inside it. That's a register, and even that little box there is a register as well. So the kind of key thing to do when you're looking at a diagram like this is find where those registers are. There are less obvious registers in things like the memories. The memories actually can be regarded as a whole bank of registers as well. So firstly, you've got to identify the registers. Next thing you've got to realize is where the combinational paths are, where else combinational logic is. Sometimes it's easy to pick out. So for example, the ALU is a purely combinational piece of logic. Oh, I should say there's always this, when we draw these diagrams, I kind of assume this, but unless it's very specifically said, there's always this idea of data flowing from left to right. So generally, we have inputs to our devices on the left, and we have outputs on the right. So our ALU here is taking inputs here and generating outputs here and here. And occasionally, too, our blocks have got other inputs on the bottom edge or top edges, which are control inputs. And arrows have been drawn on those signals there just to reinforce the idea that there are inputs, because they're contradicting this kind of left to right, or they're not going just with this pure left to right flow of data. So we've identified some combinational units. The ALU is one. All these things like here are multiplexers, so switches, where you're switching the data on the output based on a control signal, and you're selecting one of several inputs. So we've got quite a few multiplexers around. We've got multiplexers here, here, a couple here, one up there, one there. So you certainly need to understand that multiplexers are just these switches, and they're also just combinational logic, nothing more. However, kind of beyond that, and actually these things down here too, these oval blobs are combinational logic as well. And this one up here, here we've got actually data flowing from right to left, so this is one rare instance of that, but that hopefully from the functionality of the rest of the diagram that's obvious. So data is flowing from here to here, there. So that's the obvious combinational logic. What you then got to see is the non-obvious combinational logic, because there's extra combinational logic there that's hidden within some of these bigger blocks. So in particular, within the memory block and within the register file block, you've got more combinational logic, and you've got to have a picture of what that logic is doing as well to appreciate where these combinational logic paths are, because they kind of tell you then how data is processed within a single cycle. So for example, within the memory unit, you've got an address coming in and you've got data coming out. Well, actually the path from here to here is a combinational logic path. You're not going through any registers at all when you come from here to here. Essentially, what you've got inside of memory is a huge multiplexer which is selecting which of the registers in the whole bank of registers within a memory that you're going to output. So that's a combinational logic path from here to here. On the other hand, when you come into the data input, this data input is rooted inside also according to this address, to the inputs of one of the registers inside the memory. So when you write to an address, you're saying route that data to the input of the register at that address, and then store it into that register. So there is no, so that this data input of the memory is sampled on a positive clock edge and then held in the memory, held in whatever location you've addressed up here. So the address is really fulfilling two functions. There's this combination logic path of reading, but it's also independently directing data that you write to the right register when you're writing to that register. So does that combination logic story make sense for the memory? Yeah? So if you understand that, then you understand, hopefully, the register file as well. It's a very similar idea. But again, we've got the difference here is with a register file, we've got two outputs and two addresses coming in. These addresses here are only used for reading. And these, again, kind of inside the register file, control multiplexes. Now, unlike the situation with the multi-cycle processor that we did before in the course, this one has no registers, even though these things are called A-reg and B-reg. There's actually no registers on these two outputs here. That the path, the logic paths from addresses coming in here to values coming out here are purely combination logic paths. And so if you kind of actually trace the paths, here you've got a register. If we want to kind of look, want to look at an instance of this path here, there's an instance of that path, say, starting from this register here, going through either of those address ports there, say, coming out through A-reg or B-reg, going through these multiplexes, through the ALU, and reaching this ALU out register here. So that's one example of a fairly long combination logic path. But when you appreciate that path exists, then you understand the work that can be done in one cycle, the work that can be done from one clock edge to the next clock edge. Any questions now? Yes?
Are we allowed to set the clock frequency?
You don't touch the clock frequency. You just.
So all of this from the insertion register to the ALU out.
All right. So you hear the point is the kind of the key worry when you're designing synchronous logic, which is, will my outputs of B get there in time? And the frequency has been set for this design such that that's guaranteed. So the simulation actually does introduce delays for the ALU and does introduce delays for signals propagating from address inputs to outputs of the register file. But when you add up all those delays, they come to less than a clock cycle, so there's no worry there. So don't touch the clock frequency. Any other questions? All right, so I hope that's actually all I'm going to say about the practical, but I hope that's kind of got you started on it. I'm free to take any other questions you might have about the practical if you've got any immediate clarifications you want to ask about. Anybody want to ask? All right, no questions now. But so from now on, there's there are lots of labs, the 5 p.m. labs every day. Sorry, question up there.
I think the labs might be closed next week for the M1 course, from 12 to 6
every day. Every one of them?
No, the main, whatever the big one is, the West
lab. Okay, so I think it's the North lab that we're using. We can't all fit in there at once, but rarely does everybody turn up at once. But that's where the demonstrator will be. So hopefully that lab will still be in operation. If it's not, I'll double check that when I go back to my office. But if it's not for any reason, we will relocate down to the fourth floor or do something so that the demonstrators are available to you. So thanks for checking about that. I'll double check. All right, so that's it for the lab. I'm going to leave this diagram up because we'll kind of refer to it. So what I want to do now is just talk you through a bit about System C. And this is, completely non-examinable. It might help you with the lab, but it's for your interest, really. All right. the first thing I've got to do probably is just kind of tell you, so System C is what we call a hardware description language, an HDL. And so I need to tell you just a tiny bit about what an HDL is in the first place. What are the concepts involved in an HDL? And it's the kind of key idea. The key idea is one of being able to describe blocks of logic, blocks of components in a hardware system, like the components there, components that might contain sequential logic, might contain registers, might also contain combinational logic. And so the idea is in a design, we have kind of blocks, so that these components often have ports, so they've got ways of getting signals to come in, and they've got ways of signals to exit. And in general, inside them, these logics, these blocks could have just logic gates. Very typically, we have a hierarchy. So we have, within a big block, we've got several smaller blocks, and maybe we've got some gates as well, maybe an AND gate or something. And then signals from the outside world connect to these inside blocks. And then within these blocks, perhaps we've got even further blocks, and so on. So we've got this idea of a hierarchy of blocks. We've also got an idea of sometimes we've got the same block which we want to use many times. So we might design a block for a register, a particular kind of register, or even, say, something like a D flip-flop. And then we want to reuse that block many times. So as an idea of kind of designing, of specifying the architecture of a block, what goes inside it and what its ports are. And then there's this idea of instantiating it, saying, look, within this bigger block, I've got, say, two instances of a smaller block, which actually are instances of the same block, but they're distinct instances. I'm going to wire them up in distinct ways. So I've got this idea of a hierarchy of blocks. What have we got then? So that's kind of the essence of a hardware description language. And I'll show you how this is realized in System C. I'll actually pull up some code in a second from the practical that you're doing and kind of show you statements which kind of realize this. But the other thing I want to kind of get over then is that these description languages aren't just for describing designs. They're used for kind of several other purposes too. That the main purpose you're seeing is the purpose of simulation. So they're providing a way of actually animating the design, of generating signals coming into the design, and then seeing what happens over time. Another use, which we won't talk about at all, is that these description languages, not System C actually, well, System C a little bit, but there are other hardware description languages, which are then actually used when people are fabricating designs, so turning them into integrated circuit designs on real silicon. And then they have special tools which will take the designs that you write in a high-level hardware description language and translate them down to designs in terms of transistors and gates, and then will help you actually physically lay out those designs on the surface of a silicon chip and then actually create the masks for fabricating those chips. So that's a whole other story. If you're in EE, you'll probably hear that story. But I won't say anything more about it here right now. What I want to focus on then is just telling you a little bit about what happens in simulation and kind of getting over the basic model of a simulator, especially one like the System C simulator. So the key thing to think about with a simulation is what simulation involves is see how circuits behave over time. And there are kind of two ways of doing it. There's first, well, many ways, but the kind of first way is a very naive way. What you do is you say, well, I want to simulate a design. What I'll do is I'll write, at some point in time, I'll write down the value of every single signal and every single register in the design. And then maybe I'll take a tiny little time step and I'll evaluate all the logic gates in the design and compute a new set of all the different signals and all the registers. And then I'll take another tiny little time step and I'll do that evaluation again. Some very early simulators did this, but people very quickly realized that this is a very inefficient way of modeling the logic of a design. Can anybody suggest to me why that might be very inefficient? Evaluating every gate, every logic component on every cycle. Because so you've got issues of hierarchy and the fact that current designs, you've got millions or billions of transistors or gates, so there's a lot of work to do there for every cycle. It's something else I'm fishing for. Yeah, so typically in designs, if you actually look at what signals are changing on each tiny time step, you find that relatively few of them are changing. And it's actually very inefficient to just keep repeating, evaluating the same gates over and over again when the inputs are the same, because then you know the outputs will always be the same. So for that reason, almost all simulators that people use today are what are called event-driven simulators. What they do is they really just track changes in signals, and they propagate those changes from inputs of devices, be they sequential or combinational, to outputs of those devices. So they have inside them if you were to look at the data structures inside them, and you kind of were to look at the state of a simulator, there'd be a something with signal register values. There would be your kind of current simulation time. But then there's a third component of the state, which is really vital, which is called, could be called various things. It's called an event queue. So the idea of an event queue, so I have to say what an event queue is, I've got to describe what an event is. So an event is a change of a signal at a point in time. So an event is a pair of the name of a signal and a time for that change to happen. And what happens in an event-driven simulation is when you consider a component, be it a gate or a big block, you only ever kind of compute that block when one of its inputs changes. And then what you do when one of its inputs changes, you figure out what outputs are going to change, and you figure out when those outputs are going to change. And then what this event queue is it's an event, it's a queue of things that are going to happen in the future. And it's ordered from, on the left-hand side, essentially is now. And this is then going into the future. So when you evaluate the output of some gate, you say, well, that's going to happen, or that block, you say, well, the output of that block is going to change 3 nanoseconds in the future, and it's going to be a change on signal A from a 1 to a 0, I'll put that event into this queue 3 nanoseconds in the future. And so you kind of move, it's not just a queue where you put things in at the end, you can actually insert things in the middle of the queue as well. But then what the event-driven simulator does is it essentially always just sits at this end of the queue, pulling out events one by one and seeing, okay, you're saying change the value of this signal. All right, I'll change the value of that signal. Now let me look at who's actually reading that signal, who's sensitive to that signal. And then I go through all the people who are sensitive, all the blocks that are sensitive to that signal, get them to do their computations, find out when the outputs of those blocks are changing, and then put those new events into the event queue for later processing. So kind of in a nutshell, that's what's happening with an event-driven simulator. And that's what's happening. So when you run this system C code, part of that system C code is an event-driven simulator, which is simulating the particular design that I've given you. So that's the kind of general story of what's behind, what's going on. Let me pull up a few of the C++ files, actually, to show you how this is realized, so you can kind of start to understand what's going on in the files themselves. All right. Let's see, projector one. Yeah, it's gonna be easier if I do it the other way. Let's put that laptop, that one for PC. Okay, that's not what I want. Let's try this. It's doing nothing. Oh, this is much better. Let's see if I can get this thing to fit. And maybe even I can get this. How is that font size at the back? Is that something you can read at the back? Yeah, okay. All right. This is far from brilliant. I'm not sure why this is giving me something very squat, but we'll go with it. It'll be enough for what I need it for. So I wanted to show you a little bit about C++ and event-driven simulation. So what we've got here, this file C++, so main.cpp, is the kind of top level of the design there. So what it is a main function, looking a bit like the main function C, but not quite. Declares a bunch of signals here. These are the top-level signals. Like this one here is the control signal for the MUX, the multiplexer for writing to the register. So it's the where's it gone? We can't even see it over here. It's this signal. I'm pretty sure coming in here. W wedge. Top one. That one there, right. That's the write address. Yes, it's the address for writing to. So what we see here declared with some of the signals that you, control signals you see going into the different registers there, because those are at the top level of the design. If we, let's see, what have we got here? Did you ever do templates in Java? Or generic Java? No? Sorry?
I've done it in C++.
All right, so you've done it in C++. Okay, but probably many people have never seen these angle brackets in these funny positions before. So it says a wonderful story here. I'm amazed Phil Wadler didn't bless you with this last year. But anyway, the idea here is that you can write types which are parameterized by other types. You're familiar with this concept in a bit. You can have an array. You talk about an array of something, an array of integers, an array of objects. But arrays are kind of built-in things in C. You can't just talk about your own user-defined type of other user-defined types. Well, they fix this in what's called generic Java, which is something got it's a facility you have in Java these days. But also they fixed it in C++. So the idea here is that there's a get the right mouse. There's a class defined in C++ in the System C library called SCSignal, and you can talk about a signal of a particular type, and you can have Boolean signals, but you can also have signals of this is an unsigned integer type, but here you don't just talk about any old unsigned integer type of whatever the machine precision is. You can actually say, I want an unsigned integer type of 2 bits. So that's what this is. This is an unsigned integer with 2 bits. Here's an unsigned integer of 3 bits. I want a signal of this type here. So we can scroll down. We've got a whole bunch of other signals. This is where the clock is defined that ticks away. That says it's got a period of 10 nanoseconds. Or that says 10. That says nanoseconds. Won't say too much about it. Here we've got an example of instantiating a block. So as I said, within blocks you've got other blocks. So within this top level module, we're building it out of it's a declaration of an object in a class. So control unit is a class. Whenever you define a component in C++, you're actually defining a class. So elsewhere is defined the class called control unit. I was saying we're creating an instance called CU, and then this is actually just some initializer for the instance. And then these down here are really very interesting. So this is where all the wiring up goes on. So this is saying if you look at the design of the control unit, it has a port called write address mux, and we're going to connect it to the top level signal called write address mux. So what all these actually special method calls down here do is they wire up that component. And then we've got a component called DP for data path. And here we're wiring up that data path. And here we've got a component called memory, and we're wiring up the memory. And what's happening here is that they localized all the control logic within this control logic components. That's the only one you actually have to worry about. So if we look briefly at the control logic component, see if I can do it. Control unit dot. Let's go to the H files. This is the header file first for it. So this is where the control unit class is defined. So it's defined. So this is inheritance. Do you ever do inheritance in Java? Yeah, so we're inheriting. We're a subclass of this class called SC module. Here now in our control unit class, we've got lots of declarations of output ports. So these are the outputs of that unit. It's got some inputs here. So we say our control logic takes in the current instruction register value and takes in whether the ALU has got an output on it. So that's this zero up here that we're reading in. And what else are we doing? So this is a class definition. So like in Java, your classes can have defined fields of the objects. So all these things are actually names of the fields in the instance. And we also define methods. We've defined 2 methods here. Well, actually, what happens in C++ that doesn't happen in Java is the declaration of a method and the definition of a method are separated. You declare most frequently methods within the class definition. And that's what these things are. But you don't give the bodies of the method. You give those elsewhere. So we'll see those in a second. And we've got some local signals here. So these are signals which go between blocks within the control unit, but don't go out of the control unit. And you'll find in an event-driven simulation, the actual way the language models registers in combination logic is a little bit blurred. So some of these signals really are being used for stateful, useful kind of registers within the control logic, like current cycle holds the current state of your control unit, saying which cycle of instruction you've got to. And next cycle really is the output of the combination logic. So next cycle really isn't a register from a functional point of view, even though it's declared as the same type as current cycle. So that's a bit confusing, nevertheless. And now down here, we have declared a very special declaration. I won't go through all the syntax here. But what it's doing is declaring a constructor for a control unit. So a constructor is a special, very special method that's executed when you first create an instance of a class. So when we create a control unit, I don't have time to explain this, but we've got the word sensitive here, and we've got names of signals. So what's going on here? This is saying that, so control com, this method is going to model the combinational, it's going to be like a block in our design, and it's going to be a functional component within our control logic, and it's going to model the combinational logic, and it's going to be a block which is sensitive to changes in the current cycle, changes in the instruction register, and changes in the value of the zero here. So those are what we're doing is we're saying this block is sensitive to changes on these inputs to the block. So, and then here, this one here called control regs, this other method, this is going to model the registers within the control unit. And because it's modeling registers, it's only going to be sensitive to positive edges of things. And those things it's going to be sensitive to the positive edges of are clock and actually a reset signal as well, but mainly clock. So here's how we're starting to kind of differentiate how those two what the function is of those two methods. This one here is sensitive to any changes in these data signals. This one here only does things when a positive edge on a clock comes along. And now, since we're pretty much out of time, I'll just give you a glimpse of the control unit.cpp, the main body of the control unit, because you'll this is what you'll get to know and love over the next couple of weeks. So what does it do? It kind of brings in a header file for the control unit that we just saw. So this is definition of the method for the registers. Now we don't care too much about this. Actually is an infinite loop. It waits for an input event. If it's a reset event, it resets the current state. Otherwise, it'll check if you're asking to halt simulation and it'll call a special stop method. Otherwise, it increments the counter cycles. And here, these two assignment statements are really doing the work. This is saying that it's just making a copy of the next cycle signal. And this here then is saying 1 nanoseconds afterwards, update the current cycle to be equal to what the next cycle was 1 nanosecond previously. So this means that essentially the, like just off the top there, the kind of outputs of this register appear 1 nanosecond after the clock edge. And then your job is to complete this method. So this one then is really implementing the truth table of the controlling unit, this finite state machine that's looking at the instruction register. It's actually just looking at the opcode and subfunct fields of the instructions. So those are the only ones that matter from the control unit point of view. So this opcode is the top 6 bits. This subfunction is the bottom 6 bits. You need the subfunctions sometimes for things like add and subtract instructions. Those look at those fields as well. I guess there's some default values set for signals. And then you come to a big case statement, which starts saying, on this cycle, set these control signals to these values. Here on cycle 1, I give you the implementation of the halt instruction.